pirate.ie.
Welcome to episode 7 of the Pirate podcast from pirate.ie. It's Brian Green in Dublin and John Walsh. Where are you today, John?
I'm in Galway as usual, Brian. Greetings from the West.
Greetings, Galway. And what are we covering today, John?
Today we are speaking to broadcast historian Eddie Bowen, who has written extensively on the history of Irish radio and also in particular Irish pirate radio. And today we're going to talk to Eddie about a very interesting project of his that he's been working on in recent years, which is the history of pirate radio in Northern Ireland, particularly during the early years of the Troubles. So, Eddie, you're very welcome to the pirate.ie podcast today.
Thank you both. Delighted to be here.
And Eddie, we might start off by asking you to give us a little bit of context. Obviously, the Troubles started in 1969, but there's a backstory in terms of pirate radio in Northern Ireland, and you might cover the legal context for us as well at that time.
Well, pirate radio kind of dates back really to 1939, the start of the Second World War, when the IRA had a station on in Belfast, run by a man called Tarlac O'Eid. It went on the air to encourage nationalists not to be involved with the British government's World War II project. Again, of course, the IRA had just declared war on Britain in January 1939, before the actual official start of the Second World War. And he put up a station on the air on shortwave. There was two stations, one in Dublin and one in Belfast. And he was encouraging locals to go out. At one broadcast was encouraging locals to go out and burn all their gas masks, which a thousand of them did. They were actually listening to the station. They went out and burned their gas masks. There was a number of court cases. He was raided, eventually closed, and Tarlac O'Eid was interned until after the end of the war. He later went on to work actually for RTE.
And that was quite a short-lived station then, not something that left a lasting impression in terms of building up a following or anything like that.
No. Again, you remember, like, it's in the Second World War. There's fairly draconian measures to try and put pirate radio off the air. They weren't shying away from where they were located either, so it was easy enough to raid them and close them. In the period in late 1939, 1940, there was numerous raids. Which they picked up broadcasting equipment throughout Belfast, and only for Tarlac's station. There was no other broadcast in Belfast.
Eddie, would these be driven by the politics, or would they be driven by the piracy and the radio stuff?
Oh, these were political pirates. This was IRA broadcasting station on the air. It was purely propaganda from the IRA, completely anti-British. Times actually anti-Southern Irish as well, Irish Free State. So it was completely political. There was no music broadcast. It was two lads on the air and one woman giving monologues about how the British should be getting their hell out of Northern Ireland.
And while it's easy to document clandestine broadcasting from how many times they broadcast or how many stations there were, would a lot of people listen to this? A very difficult thing. You don't survey clandestine political stations, but was there kind of a sentiment that they had listeners, they were getting a following?
Well, again, if you look at the fact that 1,000 people came out and burned their gas masks on the request of a pirate station, therefore it was actually successful. Now, whether all those thousands of people were listening to the station, and maybe only 10, and then it was word of mouth after that, neighbour to neighbour within an estate. But again, 1,000 people came out on the street. On another occasion, they came out and asked 1,000 people to protest on the streets of Belfast against the use of Lough Swilly as a British naval base.
So moving on then, Eddie, to the 1960s, before we get to the Troubles, and obviously the main political development in terms of the pirates was the Marine and Broadcasting Offences Act in 1967. So how did this affect the situation in the North? Was there any direct application of this in Northern Ireland?
No, in fact, it was very lax. Throughout 1968, pirate operators as such were using the medium wave band like a CB radio. You'd have two lads, one broadcasting on maybe 215 and the other friend on 220, and they'd be carrying on a conversation. You'd have your radio tuned in, and it was literally a conversation. And these stations would normally go on air after BBC Two. They used the BBC Two frequency, Radio Two frequency, a lot, and they would go on air after that. A lot of interference, several fellas on the air in the same frequency, different areas. So there was an appetite for pirate radio. There was, in 1968, Queen's University had Ragweek pirate radio. So there was an appetite for pirate radio, and not only that, but you had engineers who were able to build transmitters quite cheaply, quite quickly. So you had a cohort of about six or seven people who were building transmitters. So when the troubles did start in 1969, they had the technology to get stations quickly under the air and replace transmitters once they were lost.
So they were effectively getting themselves ready for the political pirates, even though the ones that you were talking about were purely hobby.
They
were
purely hobby. It was basically, you know, an A to B conversation just on medium wave. But then, you know, fellas would be playing, oh, I've got this record, new record, and he put the record on to play for a friend. So suddenly you'd have a couple of records on, and people were tuning in, and it became more and more popular to tune into these stations. And the fact that, although it wasn't political, you knew which area of the city it was broadcasting from.
We are three people who know the history of radio and would know the importance of the medium in that age. But if you were to help new listeners and new researchers of radio understand how important the medium of radio was in this era, and I'll just plant a seed with you. The music and the lyrics of songs of Van Morrison, who was a world-renowned songwriter out of Belfast in that era, he writes about radio a lot. How important was the medium in the era that we're talking about and in the area that we're talking about?
It was hugely important as the medium. Again, Belfast was kind of a poor city at the time. So therefore, television wasn't quite as accessible or easy to watch. So radio became the medium. But like most countries in the late 60s, there was the population boom. There was a younger population who wanted to listen to a bit more modern music. Again, probably the reason Caroline was on the air. And of course, Caroline was, North was off the Isle of Man. So therefore, hugely popular in Belfast and down the east coast of Ireland. So there was an appetite. But the pirates, the political pirates that would come along had no real emphasis on music. I mean, some of these stations would have two records and that's all you'd hear, but it was the verbal speech rather than music which became the cornerstone of these stations. There was one or two that did try to kind of play music, you know, like the Harmony and Sundown, but it was the political aspect of the use of the medium of radio in Belfast which is probably unique to most of the research I've done in many cities, how important it was and how dynamic and dangerous it was in Belfast in that period, and how radio contributed to how the Troubles actually migrated into what it was. I mean, many commentators around the time speculated that without pirate radio, it wouldn't have been half as bad in Northern Ireland, that this sectarian divide was being egged on by pirate radio.
So, Eddie, that brings us on then to the first major political pirate station in the period of the Troubles, which was actually in Derry. So can you give us the background to Radio Free Derry, how and when it started?
Well, Radio Free Derry started in 1969 when the Free Derry area was set up. One of the first things that, like, you know, that they felt like they were an independent state. How would you get your information out? Quickest way and the most immediate way was through radio. So a station was set up. The journalist Eamon McCann was heavily involved in it. It was located originally in the on the 8th floor of the Rossville Street flats. The original transmitter was built by Enda Bracken, who later was Radio Kildare in Naas. He was an IRA sympathiser and travelled up the north with his wife, both with humanitarian supplies for those cut off in Derry City, but also with a pirate radio transmitter hidden in the middle of it. So the station was put on the air and quite remarkably stayed on the air Again, as we know, the British didn't actually breach radio, didn't breach Free Derry for many months, and the radio station kept on the air, kept, you know, locals, encouraged people to go to the barricades, you know, played requests for the men on the barricades. It was a source of entertainment, but also a source of defiance, because we felt this independence by having our own radio station. At one stage, they had it up on the roof of the lift in the Roswell Street flats. So when the British Army tried to identify it, the transmitter kept going up and down the lift. It weren't able to pinpoint exactly where it was. It was on the first floor, then it was moving up. And at the time, the technology to to identify where the transmitter was, it was all over the place.
A recent documentary series and podcast series from RTE, Gunplot, covers this period quite well. Does any recordings of Radio Free Derry survive?
There is, yeah. You can go online. There's a large section of recordings. If you go up to the Radio Free Derry Museum, you'll find recordings up there. You'll also find it on Vimeo. If you put in Radio Free Derry into Vimeo, you'll find some recordings in there. Again, there are some recordings. There are recordings in the Irish military archives, but they're not being released yet.
There is a report in the Irish Times for this station having been heard in the United States. Is that a credible report?
No. No, I'm not nowhere near strong enough. At most, their transmitter was 15 to 20 watts on medium wave. There's no way. But again, that was part of the propaganda to say that we were being heard across. It's probably a letter being sent across the Atlantic and say, I heard it. But it wasn't strong enough.
And how did the end of Radio Free Derry come about then, Eddie? As you said, it was essentially left alone by the British authorities for political reasons, presumably for a number of months, because the situation was so explosive on the ground.
Well, again, once the barricades of Free Derry came down and the British military moved in, there was no way they could stay in the air. It had moved from house to house. But again, you know, primitive homemade transmitter, it was never going to last. It literally broke down. A transmitter came on shortly afterwards, known as Radio Bogside, but the British Army quickly jammed it and closed it. It was in the Craigan Estate.
And when did the political focus then move to Belfast in terms of pirate radio?
August 1969. You can pinpoint it exactly.
This will be internment time.
No, it was it was just after the civil rights marches.
Okay.
And then the basically the burning out of the Catholics in certain areas. Again, they took their inspiration from Free Derry, so they set up Free Belfast. These were the Catholic enclaves or Catholic areas. And of course, the Loyalists set up their own. Radio Free Belfast was the first station to go on the air in Belfast in early August 1969. This was a Catholic nationalist station. It was located in Pat Lenehan, the back of Pat Lenehan's pub. And of course, Pat Lenehan afterwards, of course, is the father of Mary McAleese. So of course, once the Catholic and Nationalists had a station on the air, broadcasting Republican news. Originally, Radio Free Belfast was actually it was anti-British. It tried to encourage workers. It was a worker station. So it tried to encourage workers of both sides. So the Protestant workers were saying, Harland Wolff, look, you're being downtrodden by the Storm and government. So it was initially tried to play both sides. But as soon as Radio Shankill and Radio Orange came on the air, it became very divisive, very sectarian, enforcing stereotypes of both sides. It had taken a very quick, violent turn.
So were all of these stations on the air at the same time then, the autumn, August, and afterwards, 69, you had the Radio Free Derry on the Nationalist side and Radio Orange and Radio Shankill?
Right, Radio Shankill and Radio Orange were kind of intertwined. They were both located up off the Shankill Road. The transmitters at one stage, there were two friends, Johnny Doak from Tigers Bay and Danny Morrison. They were two friends, both into building transmitters, and both could identify each other's transmitter when they went on the air. But they went on as broadcasting complete sectarian propaganda, encouraging violence, man the barricades, death threats to nationalists working in Protestant businesses would be named on air, whereas the Catholic or not Catholic Republican stations would be naming and giving out addresses of RIC officers. So it became a very toxic, encouraging violence. And initially, the British government, neither Stormont government, the British government, had any answer to either, to how to close these stations. We're afraid to go in and close them, but they were becoming quite powerful because the people in Belfast, again, were already divided in how they listened to radio. So you had the loyalists listening to BBC. Republicans wouldn't listen to it because they thought it was a unionist station, which perhaps it was. And then the BBC tried to play an even keel, and therefore the news was sanitized and was slow getting out, and it had to be censored before it was given out. And the Catholics would be listening to RTE. And of course, RTE had its own agenda because it was a Fianna Fáil government under Jack Lynch. So you had these two sides. But then in the middle, you had these pirate stations who were immediate, who were broadcasting to their locality with people who recognized their voices, who were telling people to go down to the corner that they knew that they must man the barricades. And they were broadcasting requests for those men who were on the barricades. The power of these radios, they may not have been powerful in power, as in distance they traveled, but their power mentally for the locals in the area was huge. It was a huge impact on the trajectory of where the violence was going. It set these two camps into very distinct camps. What was being broadcast was very sectarian, all either anti-Catholic or anti-Protestant. And they never got control of by the British. They even tried to jam them. It didn't work. They just simply moved frequency. They actually ended up jamming each other, because they'd moved to the same frequency to try and avoid the British Army frequencies. But they were hugely significant in how people identified with what was being broadcast. You'd know, okay, perhaps we, as people from the Republic of Ireland, would go to Belfast, and you might be able to identify a Belfast accent by saying it's from Belfast. But they could identify whether it was a Protestant Belfast accent or a Catholic Belfast accent by simply tuning the dial on your radio.
Eddie, people listening might be more familiar with Radio Hate from Rwanda, or RTLM from 1994, where radio was used to begin a massacre. When you mention about the sectarianism of these broadcasts, are we on a scale like that? Was it hate speech that was coming out of the radio from both sides?
100%. It didn't shy away from it. It was reinforcing the stereotype that people had of each community. It was, reinforcing the divisions. It was exacerbating the divisions. And especially the younger generation who were listening to these stations. Again, at a period when transistor radios were suddenly becoming popular and easy to transport around. And not alone this, but the radio stations were actually being used as military command centers. They were able to get their people on the ground to move from one location to the other. And would know, one lad would be listening to, you'd have one, we'd say Republican, listening to the Loyalist station to find out if the Loyalists knew if the army was coming in. So they would be able to locate and to redirect their troops to the front lines, as it were, in Belfast. And that's what they were. They were front lines. And they were, again, I'm not too sure how powerful they were, but their speech was always relayed in the newspapers the following day. So they were getting the double. It was a double whammy, no matter what was being said. It was coming out. And even secret documents, secret from the G2, the Irish Intelligence Service, they had an army man in Belfast undercover, and he was sending down reports of these stations and where they were located and what they were doing. So it wasn't, you mentioned the gun plot, the arms trial. So one of the requests from the Belfast was that the Irish government set up a station on the border, a pirate station, and it was actually thought about to set up a pirate station on the border to broadcast for the nationalists across Northern Ireland, not just those who were in Belfast.
And that brings me on nicely to my next question, Eddie, which was, to what extent did this influence pirate activity outside Belfast? Did it, obviously, they may not have been heard over a wide area, but did they inspire people in flashpoints in other parts of the north to set up their own stations?
No. There was the occasional station was one in Derry, or not in Derry, in Newry. It was one in Armagh Resistance Radio. It was one around Loch Ney. But nothing compared to what was going on in Belfast. This was a different world altogether.
The state was, you know, quite supportive of the dominant community, the Protestants, and the minority being the Catholics. Was the stations coming from the Protestant areas broadcasting with some immunity versus the ones from the Catholic areas, or were they both kind of beyond capture?
They were both beyond capture. There was the occasional success by the army, but the most listened to by the army was the Republican stations, because they were able to know what was going on. You had a number of British soldiers who wrote their memoirs about being in Belfast, being up on the mountains above Belfast, listening to the station broadcasting from Lengadoon. And of course, the broadcasters knew where the British Army were, and they'd be broadcasting specials. This is a special request for the lads up on the hill. So you had that going on. But it was the fact that they were broadcasting this mix of propaganda reports and the music. So it was the music. Funny enough, the only music they had in common was both stations, both sides played Jim Reeves and both sides played Joe Dolan.
Interesting. I suppose I'm going to ask my last question a slightly different way. If they were beyond immunity because they were kind of not going to get captured, were they equally a thorn in the side to the authorities?
It was a thorn in the side. It like, you know, pirate radio in Belfast was raised in Stormont. It was raised in the House of Commons. It was raised in the Dáil. It was a huge thing to try and close them down. They knew the destruction they were doing and the damage they were causing. So initially the British Army tried to jam them. It didn't really work. And when they did try and go in and close one into Lenadoon in 1972, two British soldiers and three civilians were killed in the gun battle that ensued, trying to close the pirate station down. But, you know, even losing the equipment, it was easy enough to build a new transmitter and put it on air. By 1973, 74, they had kind of, the British Army had got a better handle of how to jam them and how to put them off the air, and they just slowly fizzled out. Again, commercial radio was coming in, and you know, it had more of an attraction for some of the younger community than the viciousness that was being broadcast by the political pirates.
But just to push it on that point, was there an equity of thorn in the side, or was there any one side that was more a thorn to the authorities?
They felt that the British government felt that the loyalists were the worst offenders, that their broadcasts were far more dangerous than the Republicans. The Republicans were more socialist in nature and trying to broadcast within their community, you know, with news. Of, you know, again, roads would be closed, shops would be closed, there'd be supply breakdowns. They would let them know which shop is out to get bread in, which shop is out to get milk in. Whereas the Protestant stations were far more vitriol in what they were broadcasting. It was really sectarian. It was really encouraging violence. And they were desperate, more desperate to close the loyalist stations. And they believed that they closed the loyalist stations, they would keep the Republican stations off the air.
Is there any kind of prosecutions of people for other activities that link back to they were involved in that radio station?
None.
No,
there was no prosecution of any pirate station in the north of any description. There was equipment seized, there was arrests made, but there was actually no prosecutions in court of any illegal broadcaster in Belfast during the period 69 to 74.
Can I just put that question again, though? Was there anybody who was accused or found guilty of other things with regard to paramilitary activity, and it became known that they were involved in a radio station prior to that?
Well, Danny Morrison, of course, probably the most famous one. He would be billing transmitters for Radio Free Belfast and was involved with another station called Radio Sunshine up there. So he was probably the most famous of all the pirate operators that stayed on the air. I know other people were involved, like Terry Hooley, famously decked John Lennon when he went to collect his pirate transmitter in London for his Radio Harmony, because Lennon thought he was an IRA man. He wanted to give him money to support the cause, and Terry Hooley was having none of it and decked John Lennon at a party.
This is Terry Hooley of Good Vibrations Records. Yeah,
that's in his memoirs. And like Conor Parland, who ran Sundown. Now, there was a couple of stations like Radio Peace who tried to, you know, be the barrier between the two and try to make peace. But very few. It was very large divide between Protestants, Catholics, Republican, Orangemen, basically.
Your research, Eddie, brings you up to 1974, and I'm thinking immediately of the Ulster Workers Council strike in May that year. So did the Loyalist stations contribute to the frenzied atmosphere around that strike?
They did. Again, you have to remember, like, the BBC was trying to take this very fine line between the two communities. So immediately the strike was called. The first thing that happened was the Loyalists put a station on the air. The Republicans didn't, but the Loyalists did. The Workers' Council radio was on. Again, the publicity was not just being on the air, but there were a photograph of their DJ in his baraclava on the front page of the Belfast Telegraph. So it wasn't just the propaganda and publicity that you had from actually having the station itself, but it was the sundry propaganda and publicity you got from having it on the front page of the newspapers the following day.
And Eddie, can you think of any more unusual examples of stations? I mean, you've mentioned some names there, Radio Peace and Radio Orange and so on. The names always conjure up these images, but were there any particularly interesting stations during this period that stand out in your memory?
Well, the two that always stood out, again, probably being the first, Radio Free Belfast stands out as how a station changed from being one thing to another so quickly, from being, you know, just trying to be a unified worker station from both sides to being very dedicated to one side, which shows how what was happening on the streets was reflected within what was being broadcast. And I suppose Terry Hooley's Radio Harmony, who tried to be the peacemaker as such, tried to broadcast radio, tried to broadcast music, which none of these stations were. All you were getting was, you know, the Sash or Kevin Barry on the other stations. And that was repeated. You might get the Sash about 10 times in a row because they had no other record to play.
A lot of our research into pirate radio shows that pirate radio led the way, and it paved the way for commercial radio and for legal radio and community radio to be put on a kind of a legal footing. Did Radio Foyle come about because of, you know, things that happened in Derry, or is there any, like, downtown radio, did it kind of come in to replace anything? Or?
No, downtown was coming in because it was an IBA station. That was the franchise for Ulster. No, they didn't feed into anything. They were probably of its time, of the period that was. It was probably the like 1972 was the worst year of the Troubles for fatalities, and it was probably the worst year for what was being broadcast on the radio. And the two of them definitely are linked. How it encouraged one side to attack the other side, but it's I don't know if. It's a unique situation, though. So I know there's been pirate radio since, with pirate radio in Belfast up to the 90s, you know, with the likes of Stephen Kay's and that, but Speak of Peace and House 105. But, you know, and even Lawrence John, a few stations up there. But this was a different type of radio that Ireland never saw and has never seen since. It's not the fact that it was pirate radio. It's actually what was being broadcast and why it was pirate radio.
We've been speaking to Eddie Bowen, broadcasting historian, about his fascinating work on the political pirate stations in the north, predominantly in Belfast, but of course, starting off with Radio Free Derry in 1969. Eddie, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you, and congratulations on this really important research, giving us a very unique insight into the Troubles. And Brian, you want to come back in with another question there?
Just, is there a paper that's written? Is there a video of this? Where would you lead people to find out more about what you're talking about, Eddie?
Well, I was three quarters way through a book on it called The Illegal Voice of Ulster, Sectarian Pirate Radio 1969 to 74. Three quarters way through the book. And of course, as we all know, COVID happened, which put a kibosh, because I was doing a lot of research in Belfast. I had met a number of the people who were involved in both sides in the stations. Unfortunately, one or two interviews I'd set up in the meantime, unfortunately, that person has passed away due to COVID. But I intend to finish it as soon as COVID restrictions are lifted and I can get back into Belfast. I know exactly what I want and where I want to go. But it's
a website to plug as well.
You're getting the Irish Broadcasting Hall of Fame. Occasionally, I do put up pieces from time to time on Belfast Pirate Radio. But it's a fascinating subject. I think it's an undocumented part of Irish radio history. Just the power of radio to direct communities against each other.
Absolutely fascinating. And many thanks again, Eddie, for joining us today on podcast number 7 from the pirate.ie stable. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. Twitter is at pirate_.ie, and we're on facebook.com/pirate.ie. So from myself, John Walsh in Galway.
And from myself, Brian Green in Dublin, 73s. Thanks, Eddie.
You're welcome. Thanks,
guys. Very much, Eddie, and good listening, and goodbye to everybody.
From Ireland
to the world on the internet,
this is
pirate.ie.